this is our new population. We have to shift. If we don't shift, we'll get left behind. It's like Kodak, the people. They didn't make that digital shift. They sort of lost in it. So if we don't make that shift, we're going to lose a generation of kids.
I'm Jill Shaw, here with Ross Wilson, and this is Deep Dives, brought to you by the Shaw Family Foundation. Today, we are diving into the topic of the changing makeup of the K-12 student population in America, with an eye on multi-language learners and bilingual education. According to the National Center for Bilingual Education, by 2030, over 40% of K-12 students in the U.S. will be native language speakers of a language other than English.
As this population continues to grow, education experts say that the needs of these students will continue to go unmet, with schools struggling to help students learn English while also facilitating learning in their native language.
Today, we're joined by two experts to explore this topic. Professor Maria Brisk is a renowned expert in bilingual education and language development. Professor Brisk's research and work have been instrumental in understanding how bilingual students acquire language and how educators can best support a student's learning journey. Maria, it's great to have you here.
Thank you.
And we are also joined by Angelica Infante Green, who is Commissioner of Elementary and Secondary Education for the state of Rhode Island. Angelica has spent her career supporting English language learners by implementing nationally recognized programs and initiatives to support bilingual learning in New York and Rhode Island. Angelica, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So we want to start this conversation really by getting to know both of you and your rich histories. And I'd like to start with you, Angelica. You're a child of immigrants from the Dominican Republic. You're a first-generation student who learned English in a New York City public school. Please describe your experience in New York City and learning English as a second language.
Sure. So both my parents didn't speak English. My father spoke some English. He was here since he was 13, but my mother spoke no English. And I went to school and I had to learn. And I'll tell this funny story because I do think it's funny. When I was in fourth grade, they came back and they asked us to bring a cucumber. We were learning about healthy foods. And I went back home and I said to my mother, you know, I have to bring a cucumber. And we didn't know what that was. And I was like, oh my God. And my mother, you know, at that time, there was no internet. You know, we actually had to go to the library to figure out what a cucumber was. Because at the time, the grocery stores in Washington Heights were all in Spanish, right? So even the vegetables, the labels were in Spanish. And I remember my mother saying, ah, a cucumber, pepino. Why didn't they just tell you pepino? You know, like I remember that at that moment, like, ah, you know, it became this difficult thing that could have been easily solved if there was an understanding that there were kids in that classroom who didn't speak English or that their parents didn't speak English, right? And when I became a teacher, I became a bilingual teacher. So I was a bilingual teacher in the South Bronx. I was a bilingual teacher in Washington Heights. And then I became a dual language coordinator. Like my whole world has been around bilingual education and then changing policy, moving up the ranks and all the different roles that I've held about ensuring that students have that ability, that we're not taking away from kids, that we're adding. And I'll share this personal note because I think it's important. My son is differently abled. He's on the spectrum. And he was watched by my mother. I put him in a dual language pre-K where it was 90% Spanish. And my son was fully bilingual. Special ed world really pushed back hard and was saying, you are actually damaging your son because autism is a language disorder. And I was like, hold on a second. You know, and for a minute there, I was scared as a parent. I was like, oh, my God, am I letting my ideology, you know, what I know about bilingual education be above my son? And then I said, no, I know what I'm talking about. You know, he's going to be bilingual. When he entered school and in New York City, we give an assessment and we do here as well. He was fully bilingual, this autistic child. And today he is 16 and fully bilingual. If I would have listened back then, I would have been taking away my son's ability to think, because being bilingual is the ability to think differently, to really push. And when I was in New York, I've opened over 140 bilingual programs in New York City. And then I went to the state and worked in this role and oversaw bilingual education for the state. And not as a deficit model, but really as something that is really important for everyone.
Thank you so much for that. that history. Maria, let's go to your background and your work. So you're originally from Argentina. You grew up in a multilingual household, and you made sure your daughter grew up in a bilingual environment and so that she could speak both English and Spanish. Can you talk about your experiences growing up and what led you to a career studying multilingual learners?
Well, I grew up with a mother who thought that if you didn't speak at least three languages, you were stupid. So we all learned a couple of other languages since we were children. And I came to the States to do a master's in linguistics in Washington. I met my now husband and started taking courses on bilingualism and ended up with more questions than answered. But I kept on that. And then I worked, we moved for work to Puerto Rico and to New Mexico. And I started sensing the prejudice that existed in this country. And it got me really mad. And when I was in New Mexico, I started my doctorate with one of the experts in the world in bilingual education, Bernard Spolsky. And he had helped with a 1968 federal law in support of bilingual education. So that's when I started formally studying, and I did my dissertation on Spanish-speaking children's language acquisition. And personally, my husband spoke American, English-speaking, but he also spoke Spanish and Portuguese. Otherwise, my mother wouldn't have let me marry him.
How to be three, and at least three languages.
At least three languages.
So we're going to dig in a little bit into what it takes to do this well in bilingual education for educating all students, including those students with disabilities in bilingual education. I first want to start off, though, with like a kind of a higher level look at educating English language learners or multilingual learners. We've recently shifted our terminology, right, from English language learners to multilingual learners. And please correct me if I have this wrong. But in around 1968, and Maria, you've cited this initial federal push for bilingualism in our country and to educate English language learners at the time in bilingual as much as possible. And that was the case, it seems, for a few decades, up until about the late 90s, when there were families who were pushing essentially for it called the UNCE initiative. And the ballot initiative actually, you know, some would say was sparked from Spanish-speaking families who wanted their children to learn English faster and were saying, look, bilingual education is not enabling our students to learn fast enough English. And so we think schools should stop bilingual education and move to an English-only model. That was a ballot initiative that spread across California and here in Massachusetts in 2002 under question two. So that was the case for a while. And then at least here in Massachusetts and other states, it began to shift back to allowing for bilingual education to occur. And it's sort of interesting in that shift over time, but it's also what's known in our country around English language learners is that we have pockets of English language learners around our country. So not every state, not every city has a large population of multilingual learners. And in fact, we have pockets of them around our country. And therefore, it seems to be a state issue around educating multilingual learners rather than a federal issue. That's what I'm hypothesizing. And also, the last thing I'll add to this is it does seem that multilingual learners, when they exit being a multilingual learner, they do very well on state testing. In fact, outperform many, if not all, subgroups in testing data. So I just want to stop there with that narrative and get a sense from both of you. Is that correct? Add any color to that to help frame the picture of educating multilingual learners in the history of our country.
The 1968 federal law came as a result of a study in Texas. I remember that's when I was in New Mexico. The study showed that the Spanish-speaking students were failing in school, and there was a push for bilingual education. And actually, in Framingham, in the Rafael Hernandez, in Hoboken, in some parts of Texas, they went ahead and started bilingual programs before the federal law. Mm. But they were bilingual programs in which all the kids learned both languages. It was only when the politicians got in the way that they translated this to transitional bilingual education. The original federal law was not supposed to be transitional, but that's the only thing that Congress would pass. And the same thing was in the legislature in Massachusetts.
Maria, can you just describe what the transitional versus true bilingual education, what the differences are between those?
The difference is that in bilingual education, when you have as a goal for students to become bilingual and biliterate, you continue the education through the grades. When in transitional, you have as a goal for the non-English speaking to become fluent in English and not their language, that's what is transitional. But because once they are fluent in English, they stop learning their language. And in many bilingual programs, everybody's included. Instead, in the transitional, it's only the kids with low proficiency. So the important thing to distinguish is between what the research says and what the ideology says. And so when the research has had some power, you have bilingual education. When the ideology has power, that's when it gets destroyed.
The ideology, though, being that English should be the primary language taught in schools?
That, and that if you teach another language, the kids are not going to learn English. And as you mentioned before, the research has shown that the kids who learn two languages do much better anyways. I mean, there is research on people my age, I'm in my 80s, in which they say that if you're a functional bilingual, your Alzheimer's is retarded for 5 years.
Yeah. I better start becoming bilingual. Thank you, Maria. Angelica, can you weigh in?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I totally agree with Maria. Part of the challenge has also been when you think about the ideology and how people perceive this, the perception is that kids will not learn English if they're in this bilingual program. And it's a perception that I think it's an American thing. You know, we don't value having a second language. It's not something that we fight for. It's almost like a nice to have. Where I come from in New York, we were sort of really battling this, where bilingual education is always the expectation. And then there was a time period where it became that schools were telling parents that they couldn't have bilingual education. And one of the things that I did when I went to the state is that I changed the regulation where it was very clear that if you're a multilingual learner, you have to provide a bilingual program. And then if the parent doesn't want it, then we can have the conversation. Obviously, kids that are learning another language outperform everyone else. And how do you learn the content, right? If I'm an MLO and I come to this country and you're going to put me in an English-only class, let's say with ESOL supports, I'm not going to learn the content. It just doesn't work that way.
Right.
And we have proven success of how it works, especially when you have kids that come in the secondary that are not literate in their home language. You provide them the ability, because people think, oh, they can't write in their home language, so then let's just transfer them all to English. So there's a lot that has transpired, a lot of policy that has gone back and forth. You know, it's almost like, but education is like that. It's like a pendulum, right? It's back and forth. We believe this is right, then we believe that is right. And then there are these wars. And bilingual has been part of that war. I just have been lucky to be in places where we can say this is a non-negotiable.
How do you think about that, though, when budgets are finite? Or do you just advocate for more money to flow into the education system? And people do that all the time. And that's an easier thing to do when, you know, there's lots of money in the economy to make decisions about. When you're in a tighter economy, maybe we're moving into a tighter economy, then how do you think about it as a leader in education? How do you think about the economics of this?
That's my job. I need to advocate. So in the governor, I put it in my budget. So the way that it works here is that I put it in my budget, then it goes to the governor's office and he approves it or not. Yeah. My job is to make sure that he approves it. I'm there. I bring him the data. I said, this is your workforce, because he's very big on jobs. I was like, you want a workforce? This is our workforce. And we could expand. It doesn't have to be limited to Rhode Island. If we have, we utilize what people bring for our multilingual learners, but also all kids, right? I think when you start bringing the conversation that this is good for all kids, like this is what we need to move forward, to make us more competitive, to bridge our worlds. So that's my job. And I continue. And if not, then I say, well, you know, Department of Justice likes to visit people that don't put money in.
Well, but I'm trying to figure this out. Like, so is it more expensive to have bilingual education?
It depends on the program, right? So if I'm going to have a dual language program, it depends what model. Do I have a side-by-side? Do I have a self-contained? But, you know, teachers have to get trained. It is more money because of the existing teachers we have that have not gotten the training. It is not just as simple as you speak another language, you're going to go into the classroom. So it costs a little more. But at the end of the day, you're either paying for it now or you're paying for it then.
Angelica, what if Spanish is not the primary language of the student coming in? How do you handle the curriculum material adaptation to a student's native language if it's other than Spanish or English?
So the curriculum is a problem because, you know, vendors only do it if there's a market, right? But what we do have now is AI, right?
Right. I was going to ask about the technology tools, right?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. We're so excited because right now what we were doing is finding materials that were aligned to what was happening in the classroom because we do believe in home language for everyone. Right? And we translate everything in Providence in particular to 25 languages. And one of the things that is really important for us is leveraging the AI. For example, we have this VR tool for teaching math, algebra, that is in Spanish, Chinese, Portuguese. They're adding Haitian Creole. They're adding all these languages that we ask for. That is pretty awesome. And it's real time. And they can do it very, very, very quickly. We also have this teacher, Carnegie Learning has this like AI teacher that helps students in different languages. The technology is moving so quickly. Obviously, technology has bias because obviously it's being fed by the system. So we still need the human aspect to look at what that bias is and what goes in there. And we're still learning, but we're using it. We're using it every single day to provide supports, particularly for the families, because we get families of multilingual learners that don't want their kids in a bilingual program, really making sure that they understand the value and educating them all.
So the technology tools, the AI tools are both doing work around curriculum accommodations for language, but also using tools for tutoring or language teaching through the technology.
Correct.
Wait, I just have one question on that, though. So, I mean, I agree with you. It's moving so quickly. And at some point, you would surmise that kids will just find the technology, teach themselves in their native language, concurrently being fed an English language curriculum in some places. So isn't there also a piece of this where the testing needs to be fixed? Like, why are we only testing multilingual learners in English? Shouldn't we start to meet kids where they are, given that they're going to have so much access to tools that speak to them in their languages and appropriately?
Well, that's a dream. That's a dream.
Well, can I just
but
frame...
if we can translate the curriculum, why can't we translate the tests?
And can I just give one data point on this that we're experiencing here in Massachusetts, and it was done by John Pape at Brown University, did research on the MCAS, our state assessment system, and found that, you know, of the 700 students who don't pass the MCAS each year, the vast majority of them are multilingual learners because essentially they're coming to our country, they don't speak English, and yet we give them a test in English as a graduation requirement. And it just seems like, why wouldn't we just translate the test? So Maria, Angelica, why?
What do you guys think?
Actually, bilinguals do better if they have the test in both languages.
That's right.
And it doesn't matter how proficient you are.
That's right.
You can be fully proficient in the two languages, but you might have learned something in one and a different thing in the other. So that's the NAEP 1 year did the tests, the questions were in both languages, and the kids did much better, regardless of the level of proficiency. So the only fair way to test a bilingual is to have the things in both languages.
So why aren't we doing that?
Well, it's money. So we used to do that in New York City. We give both assessments and the kid would answer in whichever one they felt comfortable, because Maria is 100% correct. I think I'm English proficient, but their words that I'm like, oh, como se dice eso? Like, you know, like backwards and forwards, because that's how the bilingual brain works. You know, it's not a linear, learning is not linear. So we do that. But ideally you would want to, because I mean, testing a kid with an English test after being in this country 2 years, I don't know what you're assessing.
Right. Well, doesn't it drive you guys crazy, though, given what you've spent your lives doing, that we get report after report in education that says that that MLLs are failing? Like, that's just does such a disservice to those students. Well, I don't understand why there's not outrage about that.
Well, that's why we have to focus on the kids that exit, right? Because that's when they have mastered English. Mm-hmm. And it shows you how they outperform everyone else.
Right.
That bilingual brain actually is a benefit. And I think that's why it's really important, because right now when they're multilingual learners, you're comparing apples and oranges, right? You're comparing a kid that is only speaking English with a child that may not have a grasp of the English language, but also may be very proficient in their home language. You know, if you're literate in your home language, you're going to learn English a lot faster, right? That is just research.
Yeah.
So it would be great if we could do that and transition and do both. You know, it's an economic factor. It is also whether we believe that's right. Like, as a country, we still don't believe that everybody should be bilingual. We still don't.
And the other thing, when I made that argument, the English speakers, monolingual English speakers, resent the fact that the bilinguals can get ahead of them.
Yeah,
especially
I would imagine.
They're immigrants,
yeah.
You know? They want them there to, you know, clean, do their gardening, clean their buildings. They don't want them being, you know, MIT professors. It partly is a prejudice that exists.
But is that true? Know? We do support success in this country and growth in this country. And so do you find that as primary pushback to...
I mean, it's been said to my face.
Really?
When I've spoken. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I'm glad that Maria brought that up, because I don't think you can divorce race and prejudice from this conversation. Because when you start talking about, let's say, a dual language program, and depending on the dual language program, if it has students that are not immigrants, let's just say in the class, they think of it as more of sort of like a gifted program. But the moment you have a class that's all immigrants, that can be a dual language program, it's not thought in the same way. I'm sure Maria has experienced it. I still experience it. You know, like me being in my role, there's still prejudice about what I bring to the table. As you know, the country is very divided right now. It extends to this space.
So the future, at least in our major metropolitan cities, and as you said, Angelica, across our country, is that we're going to have, in a lot of our places, the majority of our students will be multilingual learners. And how do we change our educational systems, I should say, to meet that need of multilingual learners?
Yeah, the thing to think about is parents, no matter which parent, what they want is good education. So that should be the goal. Because just because you call it bilingual doesn't mean that it's good. The other thing that we change the mentality is, whether you're teaching in English or bilingual, but if you're teaching in English, it doesn't mean that the kids cannot use their native languages, whether you know it or not. So that fear of bilingualism has to be eradicated. You can do with good teacher preparation so that the education is good.
Angelica, just blow it up. You've been in New York City, one of the largest student populations in the country, if not the largest. You're in Providence and Rhode Island right now. The majority of our students in this country are in cities. There's a lot of moving parts in cities. If you could right-size education strategies for, you know, going forward, knowing how the population is shifting and given the success that can happen, what should it look like?
Well, I think exactly what Maria described. The child can speak in any language. And I think teachers need to get comfortable with that, right? Like, what are we as educators? Part of that is facilitators, right? Like, for a long time, we feel like we're the only ones imparting knowledge. And for a long time, our kids that didn't speak the language would be sitting in the back, not participating in biology, missing the content just because the English was still developing. And I think that that train has left the station. Like, we don't teach like that anymore. And I think it is a shift for people that have not learned this way. And it is about using languages in the classroom, whether you understand it or not. Our expectation is that students are using their home language, even if the teacher doesn't know the language.
So this is a super rich conversation, and you guys it's phenomenal that you're both so well aligned on your research and your practice. I'm curious from both of you, just last words, you know, for our listeners and really, if you want to shape them, also for our policymakers, our superintendents and school committees across the state of Rhode Island and Massachusetts and other states around the country, what words of advice do you have for them, knowing that the future is multilingual learners? What should their school systems look like, and what advice do you have them for leading their school systems?
What I can say to administrators is try it, you'll like it. But I'm going to let Angelica.
We'll see if that works, Maria. Maybe it could work. Yeah. Angelica, what do you think?
Yeah, I like that. I think I'm gonna use that. But I think it's really three things, right? It is policy that supports this population, whether it be bilingual or just using their home language. So policy around that, know the research so that you understand and see that there are outcomes, because everybody's worried about outcomes. And then budget, right? Where your budget is, it speaks to your priorities. This is our new population. We have to shift. If we don't shift, we'll get left behind. You know, it's like Kodak, right? They were like the people. They didn't make that digital shift, right? So they sort of lost in it. So if we don't make that shift, we're going to lose a generation of kids. And the teachers want to know how to work with these kids. So we need to really make sure that those things are in place and that we keep educating people about the importance of really making this population, putting them front and center.
Well, Maria and Angelica, thank you so much for your leadership, educating us on this issue, and for sharing
you
your
so
rich
much.
Stories, your personal stories about what led you to these wonderful careers. So thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to our conversation with Maria Brisk and Angelica Infante Green. We hope that you enjoyed this episode of Deep Dives, and if you did, please rate, review, like, and share it with your friends. And if you're interested in what's happening in Boston Public Schools, subscribe to our other podcast, Last Night at School Committee, where we discuss the biggest decisions impacting Boston students with commentary and context on what it all means. Have a great day.